Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Since 1990, today's guest has served as the president and CEO of Monarch, New Jersey's single largest paramedicine service. He is a fellow with both the American College of Healthcare Executives and the American College of Paramedic Executives, has held elected local office as a councilman and deputy mayor, and currently serves as president of the National EMS Management Association, as well as chairman of NHTSA's National EMS Advisory Council. He also sits on the board of the Savick Foundation and the editorial board of EMS World Magazine. Welcome, Vince Robbins.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So before we get started today, could you tell our listeners a little bit about your background? How did you get into EMS and how did you end up in your current position?
Sure. My story is like many of my age. That is that we started out in EMS way back in the 1970s and 80s. We were inspired by a show that was popular at the time called Emergency, which many of your listeners may be familiar with. That got us very interested in EMS and what it was all about. I joined my local volunteer first aid squad as a cadet before there were even EMT classes or before there was anything called a paramedic in New Jersey. And from there, just kind of moved up through the ranks, got my training and certification as an EMT over the years, became one of New Jersey's first paramedics and one of the first classes in the state of New Jersey. Moved on and served in several different capacities as a clinical paramedic in the field, began to move into management, took a bit of a detour into hospital administration for a while, but came back to EMS. That's where my calling really was, I think, and continued to move up the ladder. And back in 1990, I was fortunate enough to become president of Monarch, which is New Jersey's single largest EMS provider, and I've been there ever since.
And so you said that you went into healthcare, or rather hospital administration for a while and came back to EMS. What was it about EMS that pulled you back?
I think it was that the industry continued to advance and move forward. We saw more and more things happening, even when I went into hospital administration as an assistant administrator at Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia. I continued to be interested in EMS and volunteer time as a part-time paramedic and a volunteer paramedic in New Jersey. Never really got it out of my blood. It was the excitement of being able to help people respond to those emergencies and actually see what I was doing make a difference, not only instantly right there at the scene, such as diabetic emergencies and so forth, but watching patients and following them through their hospital course of treatment and seeing them do much better. I was always encouraged by the physicians and the nurses who always advised us that when we brought patients in as paramedics, they were so much better than what they had seen prior to paramedics. So it just was always there. It was something that I always continued to do. My wife was a registered nurse working in an emergency department as well. So we continue to always have that connection. And I was in hospital administration for about 4 or 5 years, but an opportunity came up to move into administration or management of EMS in South Jersey. And I took that at that time.
Let's talk then a little bit about the management side of things. You wrote an article recently for GEMS magazine on meaningful metrics, and you've talked before in other articles about the importance of measurement. So just in a general sense, why is measurement so important?
Well, I think that in any kind of a science field, and I think we view medicine as a scientific endeavor, healthcare as a scientific endeavor, we need to validate what we're doing in order to determine if what we're doing actually makes a difference, if it's worth not just the money that's being invested, but also if what we actually do helps improve patients' lives. So clearly having demonstrable evidence, scientific information that validates that or disproves particular treatments or processes or operations, I think is very important. And once you make that determination that you need to have the evidence, then you need to figure out, well, how are we going to measure what we do? What is an objective, empirical way to measure what we do and come out with a determination that it works or it doesn't work? So I think when we talk about developing metrics, we're talking about trying to design and identify ways that we can objectively measure what we're doing, so we take subjectivity out of it. A lot of us in the field, when we treat patients, we often have an emotional bond to them, and we like to think that we make a difference, and I think that sways our perception over time. So getting back to science, I think we need to find ways to objectively measure measure what we do, to analyze whether it makes a difference positively or negatively. And again, once you make that determination, then you have to figure out how to measure it, and that's where metrics come in.
And how do you balance that, the emotional aspect of EMS and healthcare, which is definitely there? It's an important part of all medicine and healthcare, the subjective part, the relationship with the patient, and what you've talked about, caring about what happens to them. How do you balance that against the need to collect data on scene, against the need to measure what we do and look at it objectively?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that is the conundrum that we face right now in EMS. In one of the articles I wrote, I spoke about the fact that much of the data or much of the information that we collect about patient encounters and the treatment we provide and the patient's outcomes is really reported by the caregiver. So if you're the EMT or paramedic or nurse and you're treating the patient, you have an emotional connection. You clearly want the treatment you give to have a positive effect on the patient. So you already enter the situation with a bias. So when we fill out our patient care reports, I think we have to be very cautious as clinicians that we objectively report what we see when we get there, what we provide in the way of treatment, and how we determine the patient's condition when we leave them at the hospital. And that is difficult. That's one of the issues that I highlight in one of the articles, is how do we make sure that happens? And that is very difficult. We don't think that caregivers intentionally put down misinformation, but when you're emotionally connected to the situation, when you have an inherent desire for that patient to do better, it is easy for you to inadvertently sway the documentation that you're presenting on the patient care report. So it is a conundrum. I have no particular answer for it other than educating clinicians at the very beginning of their training that documenting things as they are is extremely important, regardless of how they wish the patient would do, for the purposes of documentation and the patient's continual course of treatment in the hospital after we leave them off there, that we have to document appropriately and accurately what transpired, how we received them and how we treated them and how we leave them off. But it is a good question, because that is our main problem. Most of what we document, we self-report.
And when we're talking about moving into the era of so-called big data, when you're talking about aggregating thousands or even millions of runs together and hospital outcomes and trying to connect up what happens to patients from the dispatch point all the way to their final outcome, the documentation issues become exponentially more important when you multiply them times millions of cases, or when you multiply them times all of the steps that happen from dispatch to the outcome. Is that something that you talk to your EMS providers about?
We do, but I think we do it in a very general way. A lot of times when you are the clinician and you're treating the patient, you're certainly not thinking about the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of other patients around the United States whose data is being collected by other clinicians, and it's all going to be aggregate. You know, we speak to them about it. We speak to them in terms of, this is one of the reasons it's important to be accurate with how you record the information and provide it. I think it's a lesson that's lost relatively quickly, because speaking as a clinician myself and having worked with many partners, really what you're doing at the moment is what's most important. When you're treating that particular patient, every patient is different, and you're really focused on that patient. So you kind of lose the big world picture, especially as shift after shift grinds on and year after year grinds on and you're into your career. I think you're really more focused on individual patients. So, you know, we need to remind clinicians about that, and we need to continue to remind them how important it is to be accurate with the data they collect. I think a bigger problem related to aggregating data is that our EMS systems in the United States are so different from each other. And how we're dispatched, the protocols we use to be dispatched, the different levels of EMS services that are provided in communities, whether it's provided by a hospital or a community-based service or for-profit or fire department, whether there's a first responder, whether there's a first and second responder, you know, all of these different tiers and processes and mechanisms and deployment models all kind of confound the data, so that when we're looking at big numbers, I think we have to be very, very careful that we're not mixing apples and oranges. And when we're looking at a paramedic patient care report from system A that has a particular deployment and response model, I think we have to be careful that we don't just add it to paramedic system B report, because they may have a completely different system that has different response times and different responders and so forth and so on. So aggregating data is an issue. And it's, I think, easy for researchers to just kind of clump data together and say, look, this is what came up, and yeah. here's the information I have, and this is the conclusion I can draw. I think we need to get very good in EMS research at separating out the data and putting it into buckets of like systems so we can make more sense of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. In fact, we see that across all of healthcare, and it's one of the issues that we're running into with electronic health records, in fact, is this, are they really comparable from one even hospital to the next, or even one department of the hospital to another? Mm-hmm. I'd like to step back to something you said about subjectivity and the relationship between subjectivity and either measurement or recording what happens on scene. One of the things that you mentioned in your recent article is that some of the ways we've traditionally measured performance in EMS and dispatch are perhaps not as effective as we had believed, especially time measurements. Right. And what do you see as the issues with using time as the primary measure for EMS or dispatch? And what do you think that subjective feeling of getting there quickly has to do with how committed we seem to be with to these time measures?
So we grew up in EMS with really not very good ways to measure ourselves or to determine whether we had good systems or bad systems or what were we supposed to be doing. And from the very beginning, it was the mantra that we needed to respond quickly. And I think that came from the issues related to trauma patients that needed to have surgical intervention as quickly as possible, things we couldn't do in the field. And I think as EMS was in its infancy, we didn't do a lot of procedures. We were trained at a very basic level, so we could splint fractures, we could stop bleeding, and then we could do CPR. But we still needed to get to the patient to the hospital as quickly as possible to have more definitive care provided. So in those early days, our ability to respond to the scene quickly and then transfer that patient quickly to the hospital was very important. But as we progressed and as we matured as an industry, and we trained our clinicians with more advanced skills, it became less important for us to rush the patient to the hospital, that we could bring more advanced care to the scene. We could treat patients with more definitive types of treatment, and we didn't have to rush them to the hospital. And then as we progressed even farther and more research came out, we began to realize that responding quickly to the scene was not all that important in many cases, that the patient was going to do just as good whether we got there in 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and that there was really just a small slice of patients that required a very rapid response. And then as you add on to that, the fact that we have a deployment of automatic defibrillators in the country, which is astounding, and wasn't here 20 years ago. Now, one of the most critical factors, which is a sudden cardiac arrest and getting an initial defibrillation, wasn't so important from a paramedic perspective, because the paramedic unit could be many miles out. As long as there was an AED on the scene and a citizen could use it, or a police officer had it in their car and they were closer and got there faster. So as time went on, less and less cases became dependent on positive outcomes related to the response time of definitive EMS or ALS care to the scene. So we just kind of whittled that down over the years. And I think we're faced with a moment in time now where pretty much 80 to 90% of the cases that most EMS systems respond to are not really dependent upon the speed with which the ALS arrives on location from the initial call. It's more related to, in specific cases like STEMI and stroke, how long the total time is out of hospital before we get the patient into the emergency department or the cath lab or wherever they're going. And that becomes the metric that we're worried about. To further answer your question, we haven't really gotten away from this desire to respond quickly, because we've kind of taught the public through all of these decades that a good EMS system is one that responds fast, because that's what we originally thought was important. And that's what we first put into our request for proposals that towns would put out or counties would put out to providers. It was important that you get there fast. So we've kind of trained the public that rapid response is a way to measure us, and the quicker the better. So we're now stuck where the science has advanced and the care that we provide in the field has advanced to a point that responding to the scene quickly in most cases is not all that important. But unfortunately, we haven't caught up the education to the public so that they understand that too. So we're faced, unfortunately, at a point in time where if we don't respond quickly to virtually every 911 call that comes in, there can be a very severe public negative response. And in some cases, that translates into lost contracts for providers, because the town council is trying to respond to the wishes of the community. And the community wants a fast response. We see it in newspaper articles. We see it on internet media reports about a town getting angry or a patient being angry because they had to wait 15 minutes for an ambulance for their stub toe or because they had a cut on their arm. So we're in this very peculiar spot right now where we've advanced beyond where the public is, and we need the public to catch up with it. But that's where we are right now.
What do you think we can do to change that perception? Do you think there's a particular approach we can use to help people understand, to help the communities understand, not only what you're just saying about not necessarily needing a fast response to every call, but potentially even to understand the system issues? So, for example, if I get an ambulance for my stubbed toe, then there's no ambulance potentially for someone with a higher acuity call. What's the best way to approach the public with these kinds of ideas?
Well, I think there's two ways that I think we've seen work in the United States over the years. The first is the PSA, the public service announcement process of educating the public. We were successful with reducing the amount of smoking adults do in the United States over a long period of time because of PSAs primarily that went out and how we educated the public. So I think there's an important need that we have a long-term sustained, PSA process at all levels in all states that continually re-educates the public that with a very honed and precise and specific message that how fast the ambulance arrives at almost all emergencies is not that important, but in these cases it is, and we try to get that message out. I think the difficulty in doing that is this can be a very complicated subject in order to educate in a short 30 or 60 second piece. Smoking was easier, just put up a picture of a lung. Right. From someone who's been smoking for 30 years, and it's a very dramatic image, and it drives the point home. So it'll be difficult, but it is something that we've demonstrated in America can be done if it's done well and it's done over a sustained period of time. And I think the second thing is that we need to start locally with educating our public by going to our town councils and our governing bodies, presenting information to them, PowerPoint presentations, whatever, getting time on their agenda, educating them as the leaders and representatives of their community. This is the issue related to time and EMS. This is what's important. This is what's not important. And going to community meetings of the different community groups that exist, Rotary clubs and things like that. And just on a very basic and local level, local providers educating their local community. This is what time is all about related to EMS. This is what's important, and this is what is not important. And I think those are the two prong approach. But it, again, it must be a consistent message. It must be clear, and it must be relatively short in duration. And it's a complicated subject that we have to kind of hone down into some very specific and clear points to get across.
And what do you think about the approaching the issue on the other side, which would be making 911 more of an access point to types of care other than an immediate ambulance response? So, for example, there's been a move toward community paramedicine. There's a move toward transferring people to nurse secondary triage lines. There's been a number of ways that people are trying to reduce the burden on ambulance systems by using 911 as a point of care or a point of access to care of different types. Is that something you see happening? And do you see it as a potential way to handle this situation?
Yes, I think it's already happening in many systems around the country. The call comes in, you know, to 911, and then it is triaged off to different segments. I think we could also introduce a second number that's been done in some areas of the United States, where it's advertised that for non-life-threatening, you call a different number, 711, 811, whatever, and allow the public to self-select on what they believe to be critical or not. And both those systems can exist in tandem, and they can cross over so that if a really seriously ill patient calls the non-emergent line, it can be crossed over to the emergent side and vice versa. But to your point, yes, I think we need to use the existing 911 system and augment that and enhance it so that we have the appropriate protocols to drive the call in the direction it needs to go. So if the call is clearly not an emergency, it can be driven down to someone else, and then it can be determined whether any response is necessary, or is this just a referral to a private physician or to an urgent care center, or is some other means of transport acceptable, a taxi cab or Uber or Lyft or whatever, and drive those calls into the appropriate channels so that we can release the burden on 911 and emergency response. In our particular area in New Jersey and our particular structure, we operate a PSAP and a PDAP here at Monarch, and we are frustrated oftentimes because we'll be the entity that receives the call from the primary PSAP, and the primary PSAP is not triaging the call, and they transfer it to us, and the request is to send a paramedic unit because they've done the initial interrogation. And we're beginning a response of an ALS unit, and we may or may not even have the patient or the caller on the phone any longer. So we're sending out a full-blown red light and siren response of an ALS unit simply because we had a municipal police department pick up the call to begin with. And we get there and we find out it's clearly not an emergency. So in our system, we struggle because we operate system-wide on a system-wide average with a over 50% cancel rate on our ALS system. So wow. If you can imagine that half of all the calls we're responding a paramedic unit to doesn't need a paramedic unit. Well, there's that entire response time effort, which makes that unit unavailable. And we have other calls coming in that can't be handled because that primary ALS unit's on another call until it clears as being canceled. Then you add on to that the issue related to increased accidents, motor vehicle accidents, and emergency response units, and you've got, you know, a pretty big mess. So that's a complicating factor we have in our system, and I can see that if 911 and call intake and dispatch were done more appropriately in our system, we could dramatically reduce those false responses of ALS units.
So what does this have to do with red lights and sirens are running hot? So I know that one of the things you've talked about pretty often, actually, is our commitment to running hot, and that this actually has potentially some higher risk than reward for systems and for citizens. Can you talk a little bit about your experience with red lights and siren and what you've discovered about their effect on systems?
Sure. A couple of things. Just obviously reviewing the literature and the studies that have been done, clearly running hot or using red lights and sirens, emergency warning devices, increases the propensity for an accident with an emergency vehicle, including an ambulance. That increases the risk of injury to the public, to bystanders, to our practitioners, and certainly increases the risk for damage to property, not only our own ambulances, but other vehicles and so forth. And all of that we know from the literature and from the science that's been done over the last couple of decades that we have as an existing problem. Here at Monarch, we did an analysis related to ambulance accidents of our own fleet associated with red lights and sirens. And we found the same thing, that running hot increased the possibility and probability that we were going to have an accident. And it was directly correlated. The more volume of calls we had where we responded with red lights and sirens, the higher the accident rate per capita or per mile, if you will, or per response, and the higher the injury. There's workers' compensation costs involved. There's liability costs involved, all of those kinds of things. So it's a cost to the system. It's injuries to our practitioners and the public. It's damage to property. It puts units out of service. You then have to have additional units to cover those units when they're put out of service. And we've also done studies on really the efficacy of sirens, red lights and sirens, whether the public really even sees them or hears them with all of the noise canceling devices and the sound sequestering insulation that's used in vehicles and things like that. So we did a small study ourselves at Monarch where we looked at that, and we issued a video to the industry, a PSA of our own, if you will, that got wide release to the industry. And it pretty much showed that sirens are relatively worthless in today's environment unless the ambulance is directly upon the vehicle or the pedestrian. There's so much ambient noise, particularly in urban environments, and vehicles are so well insulated today that if the person's got the air conditioner on and they're playing their music nice and loud, they can't even hear the ambulance unless it's right on their bumper. And the strobe lights and the red lights and the blinking lights are pretty much lost, particularly in urban environments, because of all of the other signs and lights and things that are out there. So emergency warning devices, red lights and sirens in and of themselves are not all that effective as they used to be. And they do tend to cause more accidents and therefore injuries when they're used so often. So there's the national studies that have been done. We've done some of our own local studies. I know other organizations have done their own studies to determine that. And we've realized that as much as we can, we try not to respond with red lights and sirens.
And do you have any recommendations for a system that may be trying, or maybe there's a person or two or three people in the agency who are trying to make this argument to maybe the chiefs of their department or to local legislators or to other people who may have say over what's done in the agency, how best to make this argument or how to convince people to kind of try the experiment of reducing the number of red lights and sirens responses?
Sure. It starts with putting together the information, compiling it, creating the quote-unquote presentation. And it starts with just talking about the science that's out there, the studies that have been done, put it together. And I would say that the two ways to approach it would be first to identify the fact that using red lights and sirens does not actually save all that much time in most responses. Second, that time is not necessarily a critical factor in the overwhelming majority of EMS cases. And third, using red lights and sirens increases the potential for injury, death, and cost. If you start with those three prongs of the stool, if you will, this three legs of the stool, I think that gets people's attention. I think it gets the attention of the mayor and the town council and the township manager to put the evidence out there, the documentation out there, to speak in terms of cost, financial cost, and cost, human cost, of the injury to practitioners and to the public, and that the risk that it actually presents. And if you can do that with the evidence to show that red lights and sirens are really not necessary in most cases, and they don't save that much time even when they are used, I think you can begin to make a compelling argument to the governing bodies and the public that we can kind of change the way that we do things. I think you can then add on to that, that there's real science behind the way dispatching is done nowadays, and how incoming 911 calls are triaged so that we can very legitimately, with great accuracy, predict whether a particular call should receive a red lights and siren response or not. And we can do that through obviously, International Academies of Emergency Dispatch and those kinds of protocols that have been proven over time to be very valid and actually reduce our risk over time. So if we can present the argument in that fashion, in those steps, I think that we run a much better chance of convincing our governing bodies and the public that we should operate in this kind of reduced urgency mode.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Just before we go, I have one more question that's a little bit of a off topic, but it's one that our listeners might be interested in. You're someone who has a very long list of accomplishments in EMS and in healthcare. And I was wondering if you could give some pointers to the younger members of the profession who might be listening. How can an ambitious person in this field develop in their career? What are the most important skills, or how can they find places to build themselves into the professional that they want to be in this field?
That's a great question. I think we have two groups of people that come into EMS. I think we have a group of people that are seeing it as a kind of a transient career opportunity, and they're coming in because it's exciting to them. They want to learn about it, but they really have ambitions to move on to other things, even into other careers and other fields. And, you know, for them, I think the idea is that they should experience it and determine if this is where they want to stay or whether they do want to move on or not. The second group of people, which would now include the people from the first group that decide to stay, is I think they have to determine where they want to go in EMS. In the old days, there was really only two places. Either you were a clinician or you got into management. Nowadays, however, the field has really become its own profession. We've kind of determined that as an industry in the last several years. And one of the reasons it's become its own profession is because it now has subspecialties. And by that, I mean, we now have a subspecialty in emergency call processing and dispatch. We have a subspecialty in research. We have people doing EMS research. We have a subspecialty in management. We have a subspecialty in clinical care. We have a subspecialty in education and training. So we have all of these buckets that have kind of developed over time within the profession. So someone who is interested in advancing their career in EMS, or what we're now beginning to call paramedicine, should begin to look at where do they want to end up. What is the silo or the bucket or the area of expertise or the subspecialty that is really of interest to them? And they should begin to go down that path. So if it's a call processing and dispatch, then they should begin to hone their career to go in that direction and begin to take the educational courses that are offered and get the certifications that are appropriate in that area. If they want to go into management, they should look to take management courses, supervisory courses that are out there, which thankfully have now begun to proliferate and get more and more. When I was much younger, there were very few management courses that were geared to EMS, but now there's many more. And they should look to get certified as a manager. National EMS Management Association rolled out over the last couple of years the first ever national certifications related to EMS management never existed before. Now they exist at the supervisory management and executive level. If they want to get into the clinical end and the medical end, they should look to move on to become a nurse or a physician, or to become a specialist related on clinical care in paramedicine. And I have several managers and supervisors at my organization who have bachelor's and master's degree in education and or in healthcare. And they're not nurses and they're not doctors, but they're writing the draft protocols that are eventually approved by our medical director on how to treat patients in the field. So there's all these different separate areas. Quality improvement is another, where an individual that wants to advance their career in paramedicine should begin to look towards what subspecialty area is of particular interest. And they should start to take those kinds of courses, attend those kinds of national conferences that are geared towards that, and begin to pursue the certifications that different industry associations now offer in those particular subspecialties. That would be my advice.
Okay. Well, just one more quick thing, which is I noticed on your bio that you were on the board of the Zevic Foundation. Zevic Foundation. So this is something I think our listeners would be interested in. Before we go, could you just give us a really quick overview of what that is and how you became involved?
Sure. The Zevic Foundation was more recently known as the North Central EMS Institute, and it is the philanthropic arm, if you will, of the Zevic Buying Cooperative. And the Zevic Buying Cooperative used to also be called the North Central EMS Buying Cooperative. And that is the Zevic Buying Cooperative is an entity that exists for group purchasing for EMS agencies. And they could become members of that Zevic group purchasing organization several ways. But the foundation is the organization that the buying group provides donations to from their proceeds, and the foundation then awards grants to specific groups to develop additional research or advances in paramedicine. So the whole mobile integrated healthcare and community paramedicine initiative that we see in our profession now really got a jump start from the Zevic Foundation, from initial seed grant money that was provided by the foundation to a group of people to begin to write curriculum towards community paramedicine. So the Zevic Foundation uses the proceeds that are donated to them by the Zevic buying group to award grants to develop these new initiatives and to kind of advance the paramedicine profession.
Great. Thank you so very much for being with us today. We really appreciate
Sure.
your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.